Now, it's no secret that stress isn't good for you, but researchers are still learning more about just how harmful it is. A study published last month in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found a correlation between high levels of stress and faster aging of the immune system. It adds to growing research about the connections between our mental and physical health, and it highlights the importance of stress management and relief. We're talking about that connection now, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed stress affecting your health? What are the biggest impacts stress has on you? How do you feel it? Have you found effective ways to reduce it? What questions do you have about stress and your physical health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Melissa Rosenkranz is an assistant professor of psychiatry and distinguished chair in contemplative neuroscience at the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Melissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Dean. It's such a pleasure to be joining you today. I'm a longtime listener, so this is a really fun opportunity.
Well, great to have you with us. Melissa, I want to start by defining some terms, if we're able. Is there a working definition for what stress actually is in the body?
There is, and I think we can all agree that what an individual finds stressful is going to vary widely from person to person. But in the field of stress research, generally, a definition that's agreed upon is a demands that we perceive to exceed our ability to cope. And so that, because of the perceived aspect of it, that is why what is defined as stress varies from individual to individual.
And inside our bodies, when we feel stressed and we are kind of feeling that we're unable to cope, are there things, physical things happening in our bodies that as a researcher, you look to and say, there's the stress response?
Absolutely. And this, the what's considered the stress response is really a coordinated and complex set of physiological changes that are well suited to support survival and our protection in situations that we would have encountered through most of human history and are appropriate for supporting our well-being in those contexts, but generally aren't well suited for the types of stressors that we experience as modern humans. And those changes are things like an increase in heart rate, an increase in mobilization of glucose from stores in our body, an increase in stress hormones. Some people might be familiar with the word cortisol, which is a hormone that's released from our adrenal glands that helps to mobilize these processes. Adrenaline, which is another hormone, also known as epinephrine, is released from the adrenal glands during stress. And these are things that we measure when we want sort of an objective measure of engagement, of stress physiology. But that experience can be interpreted differently for different people.
And when we talk about negative health impacts that these stress hormones can have, especially when they're, I imagine, released over a long period of time, multiple times, what can you talk about the range of health impacts that we see with stress?
Sure. And it really is, I think you hit the nail on the head here. It's the long-term accumulation that we're talking about when we think of the effects of stress on health. Stress is, and the hormones that are associated with stress, the physiology is really essential actually to our survival. But it's the repeated engagement of these systems frequently and chronically over long periods of time that causes wear and tear on our bodies. And so you can think of our bodies similar to how we would think of a car, that the normal functioning is doing what it's supposed to do. But when we really press that system, like if we're driving really hard and then we brake really fast, you know, repeatedly over time, it's going to cause wear and tear on that car. And our bodies are the same way. So you can think of when you would mobilize glucose from stores repeatedly and frequently over time, that might be associated with an increased risk for type 2 diabetes or the accumulation of adiposity or fat stores over time in our body that's associated with long-term health problems. Or if you get a frequent acceleration in blood pressure and heart rate over time, that's going to cause wear and tear on your cardiovascular system and be associated with greater risk of heart attack or cardiovascular disease or stroke. We can think of you know, the effects of stress on our musculoskeletal system and the likelihood that we'll experience chronic pain. Really, I often think of stress as amplifying vulnerabilities, like low-level underlying vulnerabilities that may not, you know, give rise to an actual physical symptom without that stress, but with stress present, it sort of amplifies the underlying vulnerabilities that are there anyway.
And do those stress hormones only get released in those quick moments, or is there, I don't know, such a thing as a slow drip of stress?
Oh, that's a great question. The hormones that are associated with stress and the physiological systems are not just involved in the stress response, but they're involved in the maintenance of our day-to-day life. And so they're really essential for our functioning, and we wouldn't want to make them go away. That would be really problematic. But what's important is how is the appropriate response given the context and the regulation of that response. So turning it on when it's needed and turning it off when it isn't needed. But I suspect that your question has more to do with sort of low-level chronic stressors that are sort of ever-present. You can think of that in terms of like the demands, the low-level work stress that's sort of always eating at the back of our minds. And yes, those types of experiences are often associated with elevations in stress hormones that aren't following sort of the normal, healthy, regulated pattern. And those are the types of patterns that we would associate with increased risk of chronic diseases and ultimately increased risk of mortality or earlier mortality than we would have without those stressors present.
We're talking with Melissa Rosenkranz right now, assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison. We're looking at the relationship between mental stress and physical ill effects in the body. Melissa, I know one thing that you study a lot is inflammation and stress. You mentioned mm-hmm. some of the negative health impacts stress can have before. Is inflammation a part of those showing up in different ways?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think inflammation is one of the sort of common denominators that connects the diseases that are associated with chronic stress. And I don't mean to say that inflammation is a bad thing. Like our stress responses, inflammation is an absolutely essential part of our immune response. And it's really the first line of defense when we have a scrape or we are infected with a pathogen. But inflammation is also mobilized during stress. And really, you can think about that in relationship to the types of stressors that we would have faced during evolutionary time, like fleeing a predator or fighting for our territory or fighting for a meal, and the likelihood that we're going to have a break in our skin or we're going to be damaged in some way. And so the immune response, the brain's perception of that stressful experience launches kind of a preemptive inflammatory response to prepare for the encounter of those pathogens. And so that would be very appropriate and helpful to us in sort of this evolutionary timescale. But when most of the stressors that we experience are, you know, tension with our spouse or managing all of our kids' activities or microaggressions that we might face in the world, that launching that preemptive inflammatory response is not going to be helpful. And it's going to contribute to the underlying conditions that give rise to some of the diseases that I've already mentioned. And those very same stress hormones in an acute situation suppress inflammation. But when those stress hormones occur sort of at low levels over a long period of time, they actually promote inflammation and they promote some of these diseases that I've talked about. And that's a really key part of what we're looking for with interventions that target stress reduction as a mechanism.
We're talking about stress and the impact on your health with UW-Madison psychiatry professor Melissa Rosenkranz. Want to get into some of those interventions you mentioned, Melissa, in just a bit. But first, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What stress management tools have you had success with? Do you practice mindfulness? Have you ever meditated? How has it gone for you? And if you've managed to reduce stress in your life, have you seen positive health effects? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Melissa Rosenkranz. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at the negative impacts of stress and the ways we can manage and reduce stress. Also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How does stress affect your life? How do you feel it physically? Have you learned to manage stress? And have you seen physical benefits as a result? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melissa, before the break, you mentioned health interventions. You also said that stress is often, you know, only one part of many factors that could be causing a health problem. That said, when someone wants to cut that variable of stress out, what kind of things can they do? What do you advise?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are lots of ways that we can reduce our stress and some that are better studied than others. And I think it's a really individual question. Some things work really well or people are drawn to a particular lifestyle more than others. And you did mention mindfulness meditation, which is an intervention that I and my group here in Madison have studied and others around the country as well. And that works really well for some people, but not everybody is drawn to interventions or practices like meditation. And there are other things that we can do, like exercise is probably one of the very best ways to reduce stress and to improve the regulation of your immune system. And sleep, I think exercise and sleep are like two really, really big factors that you can imagine if somebody is experiencing a lot of stress. Sleep is one of the things that's going to take a big hit. And sleep is extremely important for optimal function of the immune system. So whatever you can do in terms of having a good routine and good sleep hygiene is going to really help both reduce stress, but also improve your immune system's function in not responding when it should, not responding when it shouldn't, and responding when it should. But if we want to talk about specific practices like mindfulness, there's a fair amount of research suggesting that mindfulness practice can be really beneficial in reducing stress for sure. But having that reduction in stress translate into more optimal function of the immune system as well. And I can talk about the specifics of that if we're interested, or we can take questions from callers.
Well, you mentioned earlier that stress sort of throws off our natural rhythms of releasing things like glucose and stress hormones. Do things like sleep and exercise sort of help reset that natural rhythm in the body?
They do, for sure. And as you can imagine, all of these things go hand in hand. So if you're exercising more, you're going to sleep better, you're going to have better circadian rhythms of stress hormones and immune system function. If you're sleeping well, you're going to be more likely to, you know, have the resources to exercise or to meditate or to do the things that you know are good to support your well-being. And so all of these things go hand in hand. And if you can do one of them, great. If you can do multiple of these things, even better.
I want to go to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Dean, who's driving on the road right now. I believe pulled over. Dean, hello.
Well, hello there. I'm a 16-year stroke survivor, and because there is no defined protocols on how to recover, no one knows. There's a huge amount of anxiety about getting back to your previous life, which probably causes the 23% of stroke survivors to get PTSD.
And Dean, have you found things in the wake of your own stroke that have helped you sort of manage those stressors, those expectations?
Oh, well, not really.
Gotcha. Dean, thank you for calling in. I'm so sorry to hear about that. Melissa, obviously you can't recommend things on or diagnose anything, but what sort of things could someone in Dean's position start thinking about in terms of how to reduce some of that stress and the outlook?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think that some of the practices that mindfulness, I think mindfulness actually is a really great thing to think about in these situations, because one of the things that mindfulness emphasizes is being with what is and practicing acceptance and maybe having your attention focused on the things that are going well and what new things might arise that wasn't part of your life prior to having a stroke. Even if things have shifted and you don't have the same abilities that you did before, what's new in your world that may not have been part of it before that might be a positive? And to think about what functions you may be able to regain, and having that acceptance might actually help in the process of regaining some of those functions or finding new ways of functioning in the world given the capacities that you have.
Dean, thanks for that call. We're talking with Melissa Rosenkrantz of UW-Madison right now, looking at the relationship between stress and physical health. Melissa, we've been talking about mindfulness, meditation, and I think sometimes there can be it's a big industry, but there can sometimes be a bit of a reluctance from some people to try it out or being not sure where to start. I'll say for my own part, I had never done yoga until about a year and a half ago. Now I really like it. For someone who has never thought about doing meditation or mindfulness, where should they start?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think this is a wonderful time to explore mindfulness meditation if it's something that you are curious about, because it's never been more accessible than it is now. There are apps that can be used out there that are free in some cases to download that can be personalized and can require as little as, you know, 5 minutes a day or as, you know, as much as you want to engage with it. But apps aren't right for everybody either. Some people don't like to learn that way. They're not learners in that way that an app presents material. And so for individuals like that, finding a group, you know, there are mindfulness-based stress reduction courses that are taught throughout the city that are totally and completely secular. And so some people have reservations about learning to meditate because they think it's associated with a particular religious tradition. And that is true. Meditation practices are part of many different types of religious traditions, from Christianity to Buddhism to Judaism to Islam. There are plenty of meditation courses that are out there that are separated from any sort of spiritual tradition and are completely accessible to someone who hasn't had any practice before and who's curious and maybe wants to meet other people. I think that's one of the benefits of the in-person courses is that you also have the experiences of others with these practices to share in your own journey. And so there are lots of options for a diverse range of styles of learning.
And Melissa, our peg for this conversation was a study involving researchers from USC about how stress ages the immune system and makes certain immune cells behave differently over time. I know you weren't part of that study specifically, but looking at it, was there anything that surprised you? What were your thoughts?
No, it really didn't surprise me. I mean, you know, the immune system ages naturally. The ability of our immune system to rise to the challenges of the viruses and bacteria that we're exposed to decreases over time. It actually peaks generally during adolescence, as depressing as that might sound. But the rate at which the immune system function declines varies widely. And stress is one of the factors that determines the rate at which the function of the immune system declines. And so it really didn't surprise me. And it corroborates a lot of what we already know. And there are other research, actually, some that come to mind immediately are from Alyssa Eppel, who is a professor at the University of California in San Francisco, who studied another aspect of cellular aging called that's related to the length of a part of the cell called a telomere, which are just little ends of the chromosomes that protect the chromosomes. And we know that the length of a telomere is related to aging, but also to the amount of stress we experience. And there have been studies showing that the length of those telomeres can be buffered by behavioral practices like meditation. And so I think, though we know that stress does impact the rate at which the immune system and other cells in the body age, there are things that we can do to slow that down.
Well, Melissa, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melissa Rosenkranz is an assistant professor of psychiatry and distinguished chair in contemplative neuroscience at the Center for Healthy Minds at the UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the connection between stress and our health and share ways to reduce and manage stress.